This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
State legislatures across the country are failing in efforts to fight cancer. That's the conclusion of a new report by the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network.
Now, I'm sympathetic to policymakers, but I think they sometimes need to be reminded that one of their duties is to protect public health.
On today's Health Show, we'll hear what the report by the group has to say about the future of the fight against cancer.
We'll also find out if working the night shift makes you more susceptible to breast cancer.
Hear about efforts to end racial and economic disparities in healthcare.
And listen to a choral group who perform the last music their audiences will ever hear. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. In their annual survey of state legislatures, the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network found that nearly two-thirds of the states are falling short in their fight against cancer. The report shows that only two states, Vermont and Delaware, are making progress in enacting and strengthening policies that aim to fight cancer. Here to talk about that report is Carter Steger, Senior Director of State and Local Campaigns for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network. Carter, please tell us about this report.
Well, we did our 10th annual report called How Do You Measure Up? That shows that a majority of states are not measuring up on legislative solutions to prevent and fight cancer.
And how are the states measured?
The states are measured by areas that encourage prevention, guarantee access to affordable health care, curb tobacco use, and focus on a patient's quality of life. We know these measures have proven to dramatically reduce the burden of cancer, a disease that unfortunately still kills 1,500 people in this country every day. I don't think people realize how urgent it is to make sure that we are finding legislative solutions to help us.
And I understand in this year's survey there was something new added about tanning salons.
Yes, and I'm pleased to say that Vermont is one of the two states, along with California, that passed a tanning bed ban for those under 18 so that we can hopefully reduce the incidence of skin cancer and actually deaths related to skin cancer in youth. Youth are using tanning beds at a far increasing rate, and we're highly concerned about that.
In the states that are performing poorly, does it seem to be a budgetary thing, or there is just some reluctance to, you know, work legislatively to, say, ban tobacco?
Well, I think, you know, I am sympathetic to policymakers who have to make many decisions every day, but I think they sometimes need to be reminded that one of their duties is to protect public health. And so I don't know why we're not seeing as many laws passed this year as we have in past years, but I do know that our volunteers and staff and caregivers across the country stand ready to educate our lawmakers, and we'll be doing that this upcoming legislative sessions. So we would ask people to join us in that fight.
Does it seem like controlling the use of tobacco still seems to be the best legislative way to fight cancer?
Well, we know that if we had people stop using tobacco, eat healthy, and get cancer prevention screenings, that we would reduce half the cancer deaths in this country. So tobacco is a key component of that. I'm afraid people think that we've accomplished the mission of reducing tobacco use in youth. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this week released a study showing that even though we're making good progress in reducing cigarette use, the use of other tobacco products like small cigars, which look like cigarettes, are on the increase, especially with African American youth. The tobacco industry is very smart and finds loopholes in laws, and they have taken advantage of the loophole in the FDA law that prevents using candied flavors in cigarettes. And they're now using them in cigars. And so they've made these products very attractive to youth. So we see that youth are picking them up. They're also cheaper. And the good news is states can do something about this. We are passing strong tobacco taxes in states, but what we are not doing is passing strong tobacco taxes on other tobacco products. And we ask legislators to help us in that.
Does there seem to be a regional
thing about where tobacco will... Now, we're in New York State here, where I am in New York State, and tobacco has been banned in the workplace for ages, it seems. But there are still some states that don't do that.
Right. The great news is the Northeast region in general is doing better than other regions in this country, but there is more that the Northeast could do. You know, Pennsylvania, for example, has a lower tobacco tax. New Hampshire reduced their tobacco tax last year by 10 cents a pack. I think that, unfortunately, sometimes when you are leaders on issues around health, sometimes you think you've fixed the job. So I just would encourage the Northeast to continue the good work. And remember that, you know, even if you pass a tobacco tax, after a couple years, the effect of that tax starts to be muted. So you have to keep passing the tax to make sure that people haven't gotten used to the tax.
Like after 3 or 4 years, people say, okay, well, this is what a pack of cigarettes costs, and they get used to it.
Exactly. Exactly.
I remember we were on a family trip in the car driving south. It was a couple of years ago, and we sat down in a restaurant, and the person seating us said, smoking or non. It was like, wow, I haven't heard those words in years.
Yeah, we know that there is no safe exposure to secondhand smoke. So we're working across the country to make sure that all regions of the country understand that. You know, New York has the largest tobacco tax, which is $4.35. Missouri has the lowest tobacco tax. And this November, we're working to try to pass on the ballot a price increase on tobacco products, including the cigarette tax.
In the Affordable Care Act, there is a lot of provisions made for screening. And how are states measuring up, implementing those?
Well, we're actually very concerned about screening funding. States, I think, feel like the Affordable Care Act has taken care of that and they don't need to do their part. Unfortunately, that's not accurate. We're seeing across the country breast and cervical cancer early detection program screening slashed, as well as colorectal cancer screening laws rolled back. So what we are trying to remind people in this report is that states will still need to do their part. In fact, in many states, if the current level of funding for the breast and cervical early detection program was maintained past 2014, the states would still not be able to screen all the women who would remain eligible for the program. The states will still have to do their part. The Affordable Care Act is great, and we are working to ensure that the cancer provisions are implemented to do what they're supposed to do, which is protect cancer patients. But states will still have to do their part.
Carter Steger is the Senior Director of State and Local Campaigns for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network.
Over the years, the numbers have shown that about 12% of all women will develop breast cancer in their lives. However, if you work the night shift, the number is much higher. So for female flight attendants, nurses, factory workers, and others who put in late nights, the risk of breast cancer is as high as 37%. One researcher is trying to understand why. Allison Quantz reports.
Supported by over $1 million from the National Science Foundation, Carla Finkelstein, an Argentinian native, has been working with her team at Virginia Tech University to explain the connection between night shifts and breast cancer.
There are a number of studies that shows that women working night shifts, actually they have a higher propensity to develop breast cancer. These are studies that were done in Scandinavian countries originally, and then have been repeated pretty much now all over the world.
She believes that it comes down to a disruption in your body's circadian rhythms, or put simply, your body's internal clock. Disrupting your internal clock causes all kinds of obvious problems, like jet lag. But the disruption is also causing problems at a molecular level.
You know, I'm a molecular biologist, so at the end of the day, everything comes to molecules to me.
Now, cancer is basically a disease where cells are failing to divide or die when they're supposed to, or there's a rapid increase in cells. And those are all functions, Finkelstein says, that are controlled by your circadian rhythm.
The connection is kind of obvious. I think we all knew about this intuitively. Obviously, you know, from the very beginning in life, you say, well, you know, if you stay awake all night, the next day you're going to be tired. And if you do this repeatedly, you're going to get sick.
If scientists can really prove that circadian rhythm is at the root of breast cancer for many women, the solution is simple.
It's the simplest and cost-effective prevention treatment that could exist. All what you need is a person that works instead of 10 years night shifts, working no more than, let's say, 2 years, and then you move this person to a day shift, and then she will probably not develop the disease.
And to make sure that the students in her lab don't forget what they're working toward, Finkelstein brings breast cancer survivors into her classroom.
We do a lot of cool things in the lab. We are very enthusiastic about our molecules and our pathways, but I think at the end of the day, there is a face. There's a person that is waiting for us to solve this disease.
Finkelstein also warns her students that they better find other interests because she's going to beat this thing.
I always tell my students, you join my lab, but you have to think that you're not going to study cancer in the future because I'm going to solve the problem and my generation is going to solve the problem. So study neurobiology because we're going to be done with this disease in my lifetime. I'm absolutely convinced about that.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quantz.
Still to come, the NIH is fighting racial and economic disparities in cancer care. We'll hear how next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1275.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
The goal of the Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities is to reduce the unequal burden of cancer on different populations and eventually eliminate cancer and healthcare disparities through research, training, and outreach. From the National Institutes of Health, Wally Akinzo reports.
Minorities such as African Americans face higher than average incidences and death rates from breast, colon, lung, and prostate cancers.
African American men are twice as likely to have stomach cancer than white men. They're also 2.5 times more likely to die from prostate cancer than their white counterparts.
Ms. Facina Lawson from the NIH's Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities branch talks about the other minority groups affected by various types of cancer.
Asian Pacific Islander men are twice as likely, and Asian American Pacific Islander women are almost three times as likely to have and die from stomach cancer. So you can see that there is a large gap in health disparity in those populations.
Awareness among these minority communities is critical in the role to reduce cancer health disparities. Ms. Lawson says it's important to emphasize screening for early detection.
It's also critical to make screenings more accessible, so access in these communities are very important. Screenings and early detection play an important role in reducing cancer health disparities.
The Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities has developed two innovative diversity training programs to get young people interested in a career in science. Ms. Lawson hopes the programs could lead the charge against cancer health disparities.
One is the CURE program, which stands for Continuing Umbrella of Research Experiences, and the PATCH program, which stands for Partnerships to Advance Cancer Health Equity. These programs offer financial support to help students pursue science and research studies at the college level so that it's possible for them to consider a career in science.
The Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities' central goal is to reduce the unequal burden of cancer and eventually eliminate cancer health disparities through research, training, and outreach. For more information on the Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities, visit cancer.gov. This is Wally Akinso.
Bright morning when this life is over, I'll fly away.
The volunteer choral group Evensong specializes in singing the last music their audience will ever hear. This is because they sing to people on their deathbed as a part of the Hospice Volunteers of Hancock County, Maine. Since being formed 2 years ago, Evensong has brought hymns and folk songs to the homes and hospital rooms of almost 200 hospice patients, sometimes only hours before their death.
Music is known for the way it can tap into emotions and often ease the pain of difficult circumstances. In Down East Maine, a 22-member chorus takes this philosophy all the way into people's homes. Sometimes, they sing the last music their audiences will ever hear. Their name is Evensong East, and they're part of the Hospice Volunteers of Hancock County. The story begins on Mount Desert Island with Jerry Gregerson.
Anybody else need a program from the concert?
I'm an alto, and I'm one of the co-directors. Our musical director is Cookie Horner.
So our first thing to talk about is a new hospice patient who has a very special request, and that is the Cantique de Jean Racine by Fauré, which is her favorite piece of music.
There's something about music that touches people deeply, more deeply than words, almost so more deeply than touch, and music remains part of us when the rest of us is going. You may know this about dementia patients and Alzheimer's patients, that very often when they're beyond recognizing family or friends or even who they are themselves, if you sing a familiar song to them, they may join right in. It becomes just part of your being and has some familiarity.
Bill's going to play it for you, so just sit back and listen to this piece of music.
My name's Bill Horner, and I sing bass baritone.
Is that okay?
Up if you can. Can it go any higher or not?
I'm a cancer survivor, and seeing other people sort of precede you, go before you in that whole process is very helpful from a perspective, so I'm not afraid to die.
So I'll just tell you that even though I don't personally know this person, I know that this has been a very, very long journey for her. Mm-hmm. And it would be a great gift if we could do it. So, I don't know.
Her mother just died a couple months ago. And it was her goal to outlive her mother.
And when I offered her different services with hospice, she really didn't need volunteers. She didn't want massage, which was hard to believe, but she didn't want anything. But when I mentioned Evensong, she said music really is a healing thing for me, and I really do like music. And that's when she mentioned this piece that I wasn't familiar with, but I told her I could look into it, and this group comes up with some pretty amazing things.
We're headed to Conference Room B in MDI Hospital because the patient that we're going to sing for lives very near to the hospital, and so this is a way that we can warm up and rehearse because we're singing two pieces that we've never sung before.
My name is Cookie Willems. I've been in hospice for 5 weeks, I believe. I am unfortunately not a musician, but I love music, and I've loved music my entire life. It doesn't come through my rational filter so much as it just touches me very directly. It's a beautiful sensation, just like a bird song is a beautiful sensation.
So,
wow, my goodness, I hope our house is big enough here.
Okay.
I guess in my head, I knew it was a small choral group, and I thought, you know, maybe 6 to 8 people, I don't know. And then when I opened the door and all those people were filing in, I'm like, my goodness.
If everybody is ready, we'll begin with the cantique. So if just the...
I remember trying not to cry too much during the first piece, because I think that one struck me especially because it was a piece that I loved so much. But also, I think that was the first moment when I truly felt what was going on, where I was overwhelmed that there were, you know, our living room was full of people.
Our whole philosophy is not oriented to performance as much as how we're coming across to the patient and the family. I found that de-emphasis, I guess, on performance gives it a lot more meaning. It's a more powerful meaning to it, to what the music can actually do in the remaining hours or days or weeks that a person has.
We know a lot of the songs that we sing from memory because we've sung them so many times.
Okay, so this song is from all of us to you, okay?
When we sing that song, we always close our books and just hold it and just sing it to the person.
Touching, because I just felt the kindness. I just think I was just so overwhelmed by the gesture of doing that and the sincerity and openness of their care. Nobody was self-conscious or nobody was worried whether they sounded this way or that. I just felt such warmth and giving. All I could think was that, you know, people are pretty amazing.
How deeply you're connected to my soul.
This segment was produced by the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.